Good afternoon. In the matter of Johnson & Johnson versus the Director of the Division of Taxation and the Commissioner of the Department of Banking and Insurance, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. William Puskas, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the petitioners, the Director of the Division of Taxation, and the Commissioner of Banking and Insurance. I'd also like to inform the Court that present with me, although he will not be arguing today, off camera is my colleague and section chief, Deputy Richard Wegren.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Margaret Wilson on behalf of Johnson & Johnson, the appellant respondent.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Puskas, please proceed.
Yes, if I may, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
That's fine.
Right. Since 1960, New Jersey's surplus lines law has imposed an insurance premium tax on all surplus lines policies, whether procured through a surplus lines agent or procured directly by the insured, commonly referred to as self-procured insurance. The only difference between the two is who remits the tax. If the insured gets the insurance through an agent, the agent remits the tax. If the insured gets the insurance on its own, the insured is responsible for remitting the tax. For 50 years, New Jersey could only impose surplus lines insurance premium taxes, or IPT, on risks located in New Jersey. This was true regardless of where the insured resided or had its principal place of business. For example, a business entity based in Tennessee might insure risks in multiple states, including New Jersey. New Jersey would impose its surplus lines IPT on the risk located in New Jersey. Other states could, and did, impose IPT on the risk located in their respective states. Through a negotiated agreement with the Department of Banking and Insurance in 2008, Johnson & Johnson began paying IPT on its self-procured surplus lines insurance for tax years beginning in 2004. But in 2010, the whole system changed. Congress enacted the Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Reform Act, the NARA, as a part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation. The NARA changed how surplus lines IPT could be assessed, changing the apportionment of risks, the nexus, subject to IPT, from the location of the risk to the location of the insured. Now only an insured's home state, their domicile or principal place of business, could impose IPT on surplus lines policies, whether procured through an agent or directly by the insured. So while states could no longer impose IPT on risks within their borders of non-home state insureds, they could now impose IPT on all surplus lines risks throughout the United States of their own home state insureds. To be able to take advantage of this change under the NARA, each state would have to amend its own surplus line IPT statutes. And this is exactly what New Jersey did in 2011. As set out in the sponsor's statement, the legislature sought to maximize IPT revenue. After the law changed, Johnson & Johnson immediately complied and began to pay IPT to New Jersey based on the premiums on its self-procured insurance covering its entire United States risks, which no other state could tax, paying about $58 million over a period of more than 3 years. Johnson & Johnson now claims that it didn't have to pay almost $56 million of that tax, asserting that the surplus lines IPT due for self-procured insurance extends only to its New Jersey risks. In doing so, Johnson & Johnson offers an interpretation of the 2011 amendments that would, for the first time in more than half a century, treat the two types of surplus lines IPT differently. It is not asserted, nor is there a reason for doing so. While Johnson & Johnson relies on a plain language argument to support its interpretation, it does so in a way that contorts the language and renders the 2011 amendments to the surplus lines law a nullity, as if the legislature never amended the statute in the first instance. and it ignores the intended purpose to increase the IPT revenue to New Jersey. The appellate division erred in not fully considering the purpose of Public Law 2011, Chapter 19, to maximize the revenue rightfully due and owing to the state of New Jersey. NJSA 17:22-659 and 664 must be read together as they operate as a unitary and harmonious whole in fulfilling that purpose to impose IPT on all surplus lines insurance procured by New Jersey home state insureds, whether through an agent or by the insured. The legislature used the term surplus lines the same way it always has. The 2011 amendments are consistent with that legislative purpose. The legislative history of the 2011 amendments, as well as of the surplus line IPT statutory scheme since its enactment in 1960, reflect that purpose. The appellate division's opinion should be reversed. Thank you for your time and attention.
Does that conclude your opening statement?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
So, looking just to begin with at the plain language of the statute, 6.64, does it support your position?
We believe it does, because the way that
tell us, looking then at the words of the statute, explain how it does.
Well, the legislature has always used surplus lines that way. There's no distinction that's made therein. There's no definition of the term surplus lines policy within the statute. The fact is that there are surplus lines coverages which the insurance here is certainly within that definition.
I'd like for you to look at the words of the statute and explain to us how it supports your position. As I read it, section 17:22-6.64 says that the tax rate will be 5% on any self-insurer who procures insurance upon a subject of insurance resident located or to be performed within this state. Does that get you to basing the IPT on total U.S. premiums for self-insureds?
Well, again, the NARA changed the nexus of the risks.
Understood. But our authority is this statute. So while NARA may have empowered the result that you're suggesting, I'd like you first, we'll get to your legislative history argument second, but I'd like you to first explain to us how the language of the statute, 6.64, supports your position.
Well, again, what it does is it changes the risks. It changes the risks that are in the earlier part of the statute to expanding it to cover all United States risks of its home state insureds. To read it otherwise.
How does it do that in the first series of lines of the statute that I read for you, or any other lines of 6.64?
Well, that language is effectively amended by the 2011 amendment.
Why is that still in there?
I can't speak as to why it's still in there. Again, there was no discussion as to that. But again, the import of the amendment effectively amends that.
But if it's in there, doesn't that end our inquiry? It's the plain language. It separates surplus line policies from self-procured policies, provides a different rate of taxation for self-procured. And whatever the legislature has may or may not be, that's the plain language of the statute. Doesn't that end our inquiry?
Well, sir, again, you're assuming then that...
I'm not assuming. I'm just reading the plain language of the statute.
Right. But again, that begs the question of what is a surplus lines policy? And a surplus lines
The distinction has been if you purchase through an agent, if insurance is not provided in New Jersey, you purchase through an agent, surplus line. If you purchase it yourself without the use of an agent, self-procured. That's the definition
right.
That hasn't changed. And this applies, the way I read it, it says self-procured policies are not subject to the taxation rate of surplus lines under the amendment to the statute.
But under the statute, it says that if your policy covers risks that are multi-state risks, then the tax is imposed against that entitled United States risk.
For surplus lines policies, yes. Self-procured does not provide that.
Well, the legislature has always treated the two the same, consistently from the inception of the surplus lines law. I realize that
when it's right in the language, how can you say that it treated the same when the legislature itself made the distinction?
Well, again, that begs the question of what is a surplus lines policy? And the distinction is you pointed out.
Go ahead. Go to that point.
The distinction, as you pointed out yourself, and as this court said in Howell, is that if the insured procures the insurance through an agent, the agent pays a tax. And that's accepted from the statute because those taxes are imposed under 659. If they're imposed without an agent, the insured pays the tax. That's
clear. But I'm sorry, Chief, you had a question. I didn't mean to jump in.
No. Please go ahead.
If your interpretation, counsel, if I understand your argument, you're saying that the additional language that we're focused on, if surplus lines policies covers risks, et cetera, creating the nationwide reach, if that doesn't mean procured policies, then the addition of this language in 6.64 is meaningless. Because
that's
it's duplicating the language for surplus lines as if it's limited to only surplus lines. It's already been said in 5.59, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's our position.
Unless it was a Scrivener's error. And that's why I'm attempting to reconcile the first paragraph of 6.64 with that paragraph that Justice Leavitt just read. Because the first paragraph says, other than insurance procured through a surplus lines agent pursuant to the surplus lines law, and has all the same language. And then the paragraph that Justice Leavitt read is the same language in 6.59.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. The difference being, how is the insurance procured? If it's procured through an agent, the agent is responsible to remit the tax under 659. If the insured procures the insurance directly on their own, they are responsible to remit the tax under 664. That is the way it has always been and continues to be to this day.
So your argument is based on there being ambiguity in the way in which this amendment was accomplished. Is that correct? That there is no fair, plain language reading that answers the question before us?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. I wouldn't want to concede that because the fact is the legislature has always used that term, the surplus lines policy. If you look at 6.
Which you have said is not a defined term. And in fact, when they upped the tax to 5%, if you look at all the legislative statements for that amendment, they're sweeping in both amendments to 6.59 and 6.64 by a omnibus reference to surplus lines policies. It's not like the legislature hasn't used that language before to encompass both different settings.
That's correct.
There is some ambiguity here.
I would say that there's ambiguity only because out of respect to the appellate division, they interpreted the statute differently.
Ambiguity to get to legislative history and canons of construction that you're relying on? We have to find that there's some questionable interpretation here that allows us to look to some of these other tools.
Mr. Buskus? Justice Leavitt, answer a question, and then I'm going to answer something. About 6.40, it says that the surplus line law does not apply to insurance coverage are independently procured as provided in Section 6.64, the self-procured insurance statute. Doesn't that tell you that the mandate for under 6.4 for surplus lines does not apply to self-procured? I think that's pretty clear, isn't it?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because if you see that 6.64, which is the imposition of the tax on the unauthorized insurance that's self-procured, and 6.65, which is basically imposing the obligation on the insured to maintain the records to demonstrate that tax, they are part of the surplus lines law. So it's there's
the
nothing unusual about that.
What's ambiguous about does not apply to insurance coverage that are independently procured?
Well,
what is ambiguous about that?
Well, you draw the distinction between taxation and regulation. All those other provisions of the surplus law, save the two we just mentioned, have to do with the regulation of the surplus lines agents.
I'm not talking about regulation. I'm talking about 6.64. That's what it refers to, which is not regulation. It's taxation.
Yes, but it's under the surplus lines law. The fact is, with insurance that's procured directly by the insured, all the provisions concerning the regulations and requirements and duties imposed on agents are just not applicable. So it's appropriate that they would not apply, but they are still a part of the surplus lines law.
Mr. Puskas?
Go ahead, Chief.
The language that Justice Lubecki read for you at the end of the statute says, surplus lines policies shall be based on the total U.S. premium for the applicable policy, the tax payable, correct?
That's correct.
And then the beginning of the statute specifically draws a distinction between self-procured and surplus lines. No?
No, I don't believe that it does. It's in essence synonymous for the purposes of the taxation.
So let me tell you why I asked the question and then explain where I'm mistaken. It speaks about any insured or self-insurer who procures insurance upon a subject of a resident located or to be performed within the state other than insurance procured through a surplus lines agent. You do not consider that a distinction? Explain what it does.
Well, the distinction is the distinction we've mentioned before. Who procures the insurance? If the agent procures it, then it's taxable under 659, which is why it is accepted here that if an insured gets it through the agent, 664 does not apply. And again, to say that it would not encompass all these risks, it would render, as Justice Lavecchia was referring to before, it would render that meaningless. The statute would read the same as it did prior to the amendment as it does now, and it would be superfluous and meaningless.
If that is the result of a mistaken drafting, is the place to go for correction the legislature or the court?
I don't submit that correction is necessary. The legislature has used this term the way they always have. In fact, you know that they were contemplating, well, Your Honor didn't want to get into legislative history yet, so I apologize. But it's the same as they've always used it. They don't believe that it's broken to be fixed. I realize that may have been the case before, and perhaps they could have expressed it more artfully here, but they haven't expressed it any differently than they had for 50 years.
I didn't mean to clip your argument on legislative intent. Can you tell us if there's any express legislative history that supports your position? You mentioned that the broad language at the outset of, in the sponsor statement, is there express legislative history as well?
Well, there's the sponsor's statement. Again, everything in connection with this language, the legislative fiscal estimate as well. The focus is on maximizing the tax revenue rightly due and owing to the state of New Jersey. And additionally, to show that it was contemplated that this would, 664 would cover multiple state risks, if you could look at 669. With 669, that authorizes the commissioner to enter into compacts with other states regarding the allocation of premium tax revenues. This was something that was authorized by NARA because no one was sure what the fiscal impact of this change in the apportionment of risk subject to taxation would result in. So NARA provided that states could enter into a compact to figure out how to allocate and share them, but that the home state in the home state regulator, the home state taxing authority, would be the ones to collect that tax. And 669 specifically talks about multi-state risks under both both statutes, 659 and 664.
Your argument is historically the two have always been treated the same, and part of your argument, I think, is that if they both don't apply in this circumstance, it's going to lead to an absurd result where J&J can only be taxed for its risks within this state, and all of its out-of-state risks cannot be taxed by either New Jersey or any other state.
Precisely.
That's part of your argument,
precisely.
Correct?
Precisely.
Precisely.
Is there anything else you'd like to present?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Wilson?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court? I'd like to pick up right where the Counsel for the Department's argument left off and address the question of why there was a need to put that same language in both 6.64 and 6.59, even though the legislature intentionally, presumably, left the apportionment language intact in 6.64, while it, at the same time, in the same act, deleted it from 6.59. And the reason why it was necessary to insert the home rule 100% language in both statutes for a surplus lines policy is because a surplus line carrier can issue a policy to an insured without the use of a surplus lines agent. If the statute had not inserted the home rule 100% into 6.64, then an insured could go outside of the state without the use of a surplus lines agent and obtain coverage from the same surplus lines insurer who could have issued it to them through a surplus lines agent and avoid the 100% home rule, home state rule on surplus policies. So by putting that language in both policies, it covered any situation where a surplus lines carrier issues a policy, whether it's through a surplus lines agent, which is covered by 6.59, or whether it's directly to an insured through 6.64.
So, counsel, if we accept your argument, can you explain why you think the legislature decided to make the distinction in 2011, which it didn't make historically in all the years before?
So I think it's critical to look at what surplus lines means, and it does have meaning, and there's a very specific and a very robust regulatory and statutory scheme in the New Jersey statutes to deal with surplus lines carriers and coverage. Surplus lines is different. All of the insurance that we're talking about here today is different from authorized insurance. There's also a whole different universe of the regulatory world in New Jersey where there are authorized insurance companies that issue policies that are subject to a completely different tax scheme. Right now we're talking about unauthorized carriers, and there are surplus lines carriers, and then there's everyone else. Johnson & Johnson is in the everyone else category. They made a decision many years before these changes to self-insure effectively, and that's through a common.
So, counsel, I understand that. This is what I'm trying to understand.
Okay.
Why would the state of New Jersey decide when it could tax Johnson & Johnson 100% under the IPT to forego that, only tax it for the risks in New Jersey, and knowing that no other state could tax J&J, anywhere else in the country. Like, why would the legislature do that?
Because of the inherent difference.
If you have, like, a policy reason, I'd love to hear it.
I do.
Go ahead.
Surplus lines coverage is still subject to a regulatory scheme within the state. We've got section 17:22-6.45, which puts in place 9 different requirements for one to qualify as a surplus lines carrier. That means that those surplus lines carriers are still subject to regulatory scrutiny by the state of New Jersey. There's also a Surplus Lines Guarantee Act that applies to surplus lines coverage that's set put in place to protect New Jersey insureds through the Department of Banking and Insurance or under their supervision. So there's a regulatory scheme in place that says surplus lines means something, and it means something different from simply deciding to self-insure. So on the flip side, I would posit the question, why would New Jersey tax 100% of the premiums for a company that's decided to do all of that in-house, to take that function in-house and not rely on the regulatory oversight that they
The problem with that argument, counsel, is that it goes beyond 100% captives. If we accept your argument, it's going to apply to every self-procured policy that an insured in New Jersey accesses. So I don't know where the limiting principle is. You're making essentially an equitable argument for your client, but its reach goes way beyond a captive for an insurance company.
I would respectfully say that that's not an equitable argument. I would say that that's for one thing, it's consistent with the language, and it's the only construction.
Well, it's a policy argument. Equitable was not the right word.
It's a policy argument. And for that matter, I would point out, as we pointed out in our briefing, the states of Ohio and North Carolina have chosen not to tax captives at all. New Jersey is still taxing captives on the unauthorized through their unauthorized insurance taxes on the New Jersey localized premiums. Some states have said, look, this is a self-insurance mechanism, and we're not going to tax that. It's not appropriate to apply a premiums tax. So that choice was left to the state. The state of New Jersey chose intentionally to leave the apportionment language intact in 6.64 and to delete it from 6.59. And it chose to use the word surplus lines policy in both statutes, knowing that surplus lines has meaning. Even the tax court rejected
the argument. Well, surplus lines policy is not a defined term, correct?
It is not.
Okay, and when the legislature increased the IPT from 3% to 5%, all of the legislative history referred to that change as a change in surplus lines policy, even though it pertained to an increase to 5% for self-procured policies as well as for the category of covered by 6.59. So the legislature has used this general term when it's been doing things that apply to both categories of settings that we are confronted with here. Isn't that correct? I mean, you have to acknowledge that history.
I do acknowledge that history. I have two responses. One is that the history for a prior legislative act can't necessarily inform what was done by the legislature in 2011. And more important, I think it's belied by the section 6.40 that was quoted before by Justice Fernandez-Vina to say that surplus lines law does not apply to self-procured insurance. So there is an understanding.
How does that address the argument, the response of your adversary, that that law is a regulatory one? It's not dealing with the taxation and revenue generating that the legislature is addressing in 0.59 and 0.64.
Well, I'm a tax attorney by trade, and very few of the taxing statutes appear in the insurance regulatory scheme, but this is where they do. So the taxing statutes are built into the Surplus Lines Act and are part of the insurance statutes. So I think they have to be read cohesively, for one. And second, I'm glad you raised the point about maximizing revenue, because the Council for the Departments has repeatedly said that there's express legislative history that says that the legislature intended to maximize revenue when it made these changes in 2011. And that's incorrect. Mm-hmm. The statement in the legislative history, and right now I'm looking at one example, but it's repeated several times in the same way. On 51A of our joint appendix, this speaks to the fact that when the NRRA was passed and it authorized states for surplus lines policies, whatever that means, to expand to the home state 100% rule, it also authorized a construct where states could, instead of doing that, of adopting 100% rule, They could instead enter into a compact and negotiate the way in which insurance premiums would be taxed and shared and apportioned among the states. And when counsel for the department cites the language regarding maximizing revenue, it's specific to negotiating that compact. It's very clear. It says the bill authorizes the Commissioner of Banking and Insurance to enter into compacts or agreements with other states, and I'm paraphrasing, but in order to maximize tax revenue rightly due and owing to the state. So the maximizing revenue language that's been quoted repeatedly is not specific to the actual language that we're talking about here. It's specific to a separate mission to go and potentially negotiate a compact, which never did come to fruition.
Isn't it true that when NERA was passed, the Congress had a delayed effective date for it to allow states the opportunity to react and plan to the multiple effects of NERA? One, the loss of revenue as a result of the change, as well as what they could do to recapture some of it. So maybe the references to maximize revenue is to assess the impact of NERA on the change in which the state would approach its taxing of IPT and make the best judgment that it could in terms of a going forward policy. Would that be a fair interpretation of what seemed to have happened here with the legislature?
Well, I definitely agree, Your Honor, that there was a one-year lag time from the federal act to give states time to react. And so from my perspective, that means that the legislature of this state and of every state had time to consider the language that they chose. They didn't have to rush into that. But the specific statutory or legislative intent language that's been quoted by counsel for the departments is not in that generalized fashion. It is very specific to the authority given to the Commissioner of Banking and Insurance to enter into compacts or agreements. So it's
Ms.
not
Wilson,
respect to this language. Yes.
Is it your understanding, tracing the history that Mr. Paskus was walking us through from NERA through the 2011 amendments and some of the legislative history that he has spoken to, that the legislature specifically intended to treat IPT differently for these two different areas, or that it made a mistake in drafting?
I think the legislature specifically intended a different result. I think since the Evanston case, it's been known that it was possible for a New Jersey insured to leave the state and acquire insurance from the same type of surplus lines carrier that they could have acquired it through an agent, but they could acquire that independently. The Howell case that the departments repeatedly cite in their briefing deals with exactly that situation, and it explains why both statutes need to address surplus lines carriers. In Howell, that was a question of whether there was jurisdiction. New Jersey had jurisdiction to tax that insurance premium, even though the insured was saying that it was outside of due process. But the facts of Howell were such that they had gone outside the state. A New Jersey principal place of business, they ran an amusement park in New Jersey. They went outside the state. They didn't use a surplus lines agent, but they acquired insurance from carriers that were acknowledged in the decision to be surplus lines carriers. So that's exactly the scenario that we're talking about here. The legislature has wanted to make sure that they were able to tax premiums under both scenarios for a surplus lines carrier and acknowledge that there are situations where a surplus lines carrier could issue coverage that falls under 6.64 and not under 6.59. And so we have to assume that the legislature knew what they were saying when they said surplus lines policy. And it's the same as if you would refer to a dog's bowl, the dog bowl. It's an adjective that's used to describe a noun based on the relevant actor. So here, a surplus lines policy means a policy that was issued by a surplus lines carrier, and that has meaning under the New Jersey statutes. I'd also like to point out that if one were to accept the arguments of the department that there's a generalized legislative intent to maximize revenue whenever you're passing a tax statute, that would eviscerate the longstanding principle of statutory construction that ambiguous tax statutes are construed against the government. So even if one did accept the premise that there's an ambiguity in this statute, which we don't accept, It is a taxing statute, and it must be construed against the government.
Can I ask
you
one question,
If you don't agree
counsel,
that it was ambiguous, why did J&J pay the tax for several years before changing its position?
Well, that's Your Honor, that's why refund statutes exist in every aspect of state taxation. There was a change in the law, and companies like the were left to decide what the meaning of that law was. Johnson & Johnson at first took the conservative position and paid the tax while they continued to evaluate. And when they studied the language, they decided that they were in the that their construction was correct, that the same apportionment provision that had been in the statute before remained in the statute. They exercised their right, as any taxpayer would, to pursue a refund within the statute of limitations, to ask the agencies to look at that refund claim and decide whether they were in fact eligible for the refund or not based on the plain language of the statute. And then they pursued their right to come to court and have that issue decided by this body.
So counsel, I just have one question, and forgive me if I'm repeating myself. I'm just trying to understand the policy distinction. So if J&J had gone through a surplus lines agent to insure the very risks that it wound up insuring through its captive insurance company, it would have been taxed, right, under the IPT, correct? But those same risks that are insured through its captive insurance company cannot be taxed. I'm trying to think, like, what state policy is advanced by that type of distinction?
Yes, Your Honor. If Johnson & Johnson had been able to and did instead obtain coverage through a surplus lines agent from a surplus lines carrier, they would have had the protection of the Surplus Lines Guarantee Act, for one. They would have had the protection of all of the state regulatory requirements that are placed on surplus lines carriers in order to protect policyholders. Even the department's petition explains that the legislative history of the Surplus Lines Act says that it was put in place to protect the public from fiscally irresponsible surplus lines insurers and dishonest surplus lines agents. There's an entire regulatory scheme. There's the protection of the Guarantee Act. All of that is in place to protect those New Jersey policyholders who choose to procure their insurance in that way. Johnson & Johnson instead did not ask the state of New Jersey to do any of that for them. They determined instead to bring all of that function in-house. Johnson & Johnson is the one where the buck stops. It's responsible for analyzing risk, for making sure that they're adequately covered. They don't ask the state of New Jersey to do any of that work. That's what explains, I think, why Ohio and North Carolina have chosen not to tax premiums on captive insurance whatsoever.
Thank you.
Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Wilson?
Chief, I actually have sort of a foolish question.
Go ahead.
But just
go ahead.
In my simple mind, I always thought these captive insurance companies were created by a Johnson & Johnson or other that could essentially self-insure the risk, because they couldn't obtain surplus lines for the risk in the market. And that was the only way they were permitted to create these non-admitted captive insurance companies. I thought they couldn't essentially get a surplus lines carrier to cover the loss. And that's why they were allowed to create their own entity. Am I wrong?
I think you're a little bit.
Okay.
A captive insurance company. So the Department of Banking and Insurance's own website describes a captive insurance company as something that businesses use to manage their insurance costs and to assume their own risks. So it's a decision to bring that in-house. And for many years, New Jersey did not allow one to create a New Jersey-specific captive. Johnson & Johnson's is based in Vermont. In, I think it was the same year, it was either 2010 or 2011, the state of New Jersey now does authorize a captive insurance company to be created under the auspices of New Jersey law. So it's a self-insurance mechanism. It's not necessarily a mechanism to obtain coverage that can't be obtained elsewhere. That might be the purpose for doing it, Justice Solomon. But you are correct with respect to surplus lines coverage, that can only be obtained if there's been a determination made that coverage can't be acquired from an authorized insurance company within the state.
Got it backwards.
Thank you.
So,
Mr. Puskas, please, if you'd like to wrap up your argument.
If I could, Your Honor, thank you. I just wanted to ask the court to carefully consider the very precise construction that the appellate division gave, which rationalizes all of these different constructs. And it does give effect to the fact that the apportionment language was left intact in 6.64. And it does give effect to the fact that surplus lines has a meaning consistent with the Surplus Lines Act, which does not include the type of unauthorized captive insurance at issue here. So Johnson & Johnson respectfully requests that the court affirm the well-reasoned decision of the appellate division. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Puskas.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to point out that counsel tries to create a false dichotomy within 664 as to there are surplus lines insurers and there's other insurers, and we're another insurer. That's not the case at all. The fact of the matter is, to be a surplus lines insurer under the surplus lines law, an agent has to propose you to the commissioner, and basically the insurer just submits proof of financial solvency to that. The department does not regulate these insurers in any way. The only import of being a surplus lines insurer is that surplus lines agents can procure insurance from them. Otherwise, the insurers are just another unauthorized insurer. This was the case in Howe, and again, it was a distinction without a difference. Howe said, if the surplus lines is obtained through an agent, and in that case it was a surplus lines insurer, so they could have gotten it through an agent, but they didn't, and they decided to get it on their own, so they pay the tax there. It was really a distinction without a difference here. With respect to the compacts, again, those are subject, the Budget Committee actually proposed an amendment to the statute before it was voted upon and was included, that the Joint Budget Oversight Committee can nullify any compact that the commissioner would seek to get into. And one of the factors considering there was the revenue. At the time, and again, you can look at the same citation in the appendix that council raised at 51A, they recognized the state that doesn't join an agreement may collect 100% of the taxes due from their insureds located that are their home state insureds. This includes the continued ability to collect all premium taxes owed by home and state insureds. But if you're not established a compact, then you wouldn't be able to assert taxation, collect taxes on your home state insured's risks that were in other states. The point of it being nobody knew what the revenue was going to be then. And 669, the statute that authorizes the commission to enter into the compacts, talks about multi-state risks under not just 659, but also 664. So the legislature was clearly contemplating that 664 would apply to all United States risks of its home state insureds that self-procured their insurance. Also, two final points. The council had raised the fact about that if there is a ambiguity of any kind in a statute, it needs to be strictly construed against the state and in favor of the taxpayer. That was set forth in Fetters in 1984, But in DeFetter's case, they clearly said where there is no legislative history existing that dispels that doubt. And here there's significant history as to what the legislative intent was. Also, Stryker was modified later on by, Fetters was modified by Stryker's back in 2001, where they, although they acknowledged that, they said that the statutes must also be construed reasonably so that the legislature's purpose in enacting the statute is not destroyed. And they said that in tax matters, it is acutely true that substance prevails over form. And that is the case here. Finally, counsel took great pains to say how Johnson & Johnson went out and said, well, we don't need the all the protection of the department regarding the procurement of our insurance. We'll take care of that in-house. We have our own risk management personnel, and we'll create a captive to do it. The fact of a captive is meaningless here. They are an unauthorized insurer, and Johnson & Johnson has that right to go out and seek insurance from wherever they want. They can forego those protections, but they can't use that to avoid the tax. Thank you very much.
Mr. Puskas, you were very respectful and patient when I was asking you a number of questions as you tried to lay out your understanding of the plain language. I want to make sure you have a chance to do that without interruption. Can you walk us through briefly 6.64 and explain again why the plain language supports your position?
It was because of the change of risks. The amendment is what changes the existing language. The existing language there is what applied to risks in New Jersey. So when the legislature amended it by the insertion of the new paragraph in 664, the same as in 659, it served to expand that scope of risks. We've established that the use of the term surplus lines policy does refer to all that unauthorized insurance that's procured without whether with an agent or without an agent. So the amendment was an effective modification of the allocation of risks set forth that was originally in the statute. It would have been clearer, perhaps,
if surplus lines means what you say it does, then why is there a distinction in 640 that says it does not apply to those coverages that are independently procured? Why is there a differentiation there between surplus lines and self-procured lines if you say that they have the same meaning in legislative history and throughout the entirety of the statutes? Why then did they draw a distinction there?
Well, again, Your Honor, the beginning part of 640 says that these statutes, 664 and 665,
I'm just asking you about that section of 640. Why is it there a distinction drawn there in that part of statute if you say that surplus lines has always meant all these lines and that there's no difference in any of them? Why is that there?
The distinction is all those other provisions of the Act apply to the regulation of surplus lines agents, which, again, a taxpayer like Johnson & Johnson can choose not to avail themselves of, but they can't choose to avoid the tax.
But why did they use, if you say they're interchangeable, but they mean the same, they're synonymous, why is there a difference in that part of the language of statute? Why did the legislature feel compelled to make that distinction if you say that they both have the same meaning everywhere?
I would submit that there isn't a distinction because it is a part of the surplus lines law. So there's nothing
it says does not apply to insurance coverages that are independently procured and provided in this section. So it does make a distinction. It doesn't say they're the same. So how does that reconcile with the argument you make to this court that Pepper's lines means all of those lines?
Again, because of what the impact of those other statutes are. Those other statutes say nothing about taxation except for the fact of 659.
But this one does.
Well, again, if you look at 639, the statute right before it, which was enacted at the same time as 640 in the same law, it talks about what unauthorized insurers can't do, that they can't bring any actions under their policies or such. And one of the exceptions on that, they talk about surplus lines policies procured, surplus lines coverages lawfully written under the surplus lines law. Certainly, they didn't.
Sir, that's okay. Either you don't understand my question or you're choosing not to really explain it to me. It's okay.
Can I ask one last question? I get it.
Jesus.
It's probably a foolish question. It's very simple. It'll be brief. You said 664 changed the allocation of risk or changed the risk for New Jersey insureds. Is that what you meant? 664 changed the allocation of risk?
Well, it changes the risk that the tax could be imposed upon.
Okay,
the risk,
when I think of
the risk,
risk
remained the same because it's a taxing statute. And it's
I got you. As far as I know, 664 has nothing to do with the risk that's being insured. It has to do with the tax that's being paid. Correct?
Yes, but it describes what the risks are. Again, the language that has been a big part of our controversy.
No, explain that to me. Risk to me is the thing you're insuring against. And
that's
664
correct.
has absolutely nothing to do with the risk. It has to do with the tax you're paying for insuring the risk.
Right, but you have to go from risk to premium to taxes.
Right.
The premiums
right.
are assessed on the risks, and then the taxes are assessed on the premiums.
Okay, I understand that. I understand that.
And I hate to keep, Mr. Puskas, I hate to keep going back to the language again at the beginning of 664, but do you think it was error for the legislature to keep in the language that indicated that the tax would be applied to insurance upon a subject of insurance resident and located to be formed within the state? I mean, I'm still having trouble understanding why that language is still in there after it was amended, if it was supposed to allow the allocation, the IPT, to be applied throughout the United States.
Well, I would submit that the legislature didn't think so. This is all surplus lines. We're taxing it all. We're taxing it the same. Again, prior to the NARA and the authority that was given under that, we taxed all unauthorized insurance, whether it was gotten through an agent or gotten directly Jersey risks.
Can you tell me where I can find that on the sponsor statements or the legislative history? What you're saying?
Can find what you're...
What the statement you just made about what the legislature meant and what they wanted. Can you tell me where I can find it?
It's not in
I haven't
the sponsor
found that.
It's not in a sponsor statement, but the fact is...
Is it in the legislative history at all and the arguments when they were discussing it?
Well, it's from the absence of it. You know, Sherlock Holmes once remarked upon the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, the curious incident being that the dog said nothing. The fact is that the legislature has never... ever said anything about self-procured insurance except in conjunction with surplus lines.
When the dog says nothing, should we just take it that it's a dog and not look into anything else? Should we just apply the plain language then if the dog said nothing?
You should apply the language as it has been used consistently. Again, there's no definition of it, so the best indicator of what that plain language is the way that the legislature has used it for the past half century.
That may be a good place to
end. It was not NNRA then. I'm sorry, Chief. Go ahead.
Is there anything, Justice Fernandez-Bina, please finish your line of questioning.
Sorry. No, I'm done.
Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Puskas?
No, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you to both counsel for very helpful arguments.